I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Go! Go! No, Santa! No, Santa! No, Santa! Asile, amica!
Thank you! Thank you, Mr. Bush!
Just days after the first U.S. tanks rolled into Baghdad, reporters are telling us this morning that the regime of Saddam Hussein is finished.
There's an absence of authority, a vacuum of authority for most people. That most haven't seen the Americans yet, and the Iraqis have disappeared. The Iraqi information minister did not turn up today. As far as we're concerned, senior officials from the information ministry have disappeared, as have the security and intelligence who were blanketing our every move.
For weeks, we've been under Iraqi restrictions, controlled in where we can go, and some of our broadcasts listened to by officials. All those officials have now vanished. They didn't turn up for work this morning, and for the moment at least, we're free to travel round as we wish. There are no signs we can see of Iraqi forces on the streets. Crowds have been seen shouting anti-Saddam slogans, and nobody's there to stop it. There may still be pockets of resistance, but we appear to be closer to the end.
State television is off the air. We couldn't get radio today. And so people are, you know, sort of saying, where's the government? Where's Saddam Hussein? What's going on? It's over. Iraqis believe that it's over.
U.S. soldiers are moving closer to the center of the city. They are passing scenes of cheering residents and, of course, the looting of government buildings. At this very moment, a U.S. tank has backed up to a vast statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square that has a loop around its neck and will likely be torn down within the next hour. Andy Nelson is a photographer with the Christian Science Monitor. We reached him on his satellite phone.
Well, what I've been doing today is traveling in some of the northeastern suburbs of Baghdad and seeing the armored assault vehicles as they've been moving in, the tanks, things like that, and also the reaction of the Iraqi people as the Marines have been moving forward in towards the center of the city.
Tell me what you're seeing. What is that reaction?
The reaction that I've seen has been overwhelmingly positive. People standing along the street, waving to the troops as they're passing by in their armored vehicles. And also, even when soldiers have gotten out, I had one soldier tell me that a man came up and kissed him on the cheek, telling him how glad he was that he was there. It's been almost a universally positive acceptance of the troops.
Any signs, any sounds of fighting at all, Andy, or does that all appear to have moved to other parts of the city, distant parts of the city?
No, actually, when we were progressing towards the front line, we did hear what sounded like 50 caliber machine gun fire, as well as some booms off into the distance. Also, there have been jet aircraft flying overhead, providing close air support, and occasionally we've heard some louder rumbles, which would indicate there may be still some bombing going on. But I don't have any way to actually confirm that.
So the Iraqis that you've seen today, the soldiers that you've had a chance to talk to, are they in effect telling you that that Baghdad has fallen now, it's largely in control of American forces?
Well, I think that in the areas that the Americans have gone through, that indeed it is the sense that Baghdad has fallen, and that the people are realizing that the regime no longer exists. Another sign of that would be the government buildings and other things that people are going into and basically stripping bare of everything inside of and hauling those goods off to their home. They fear no reprisal at all at this point, so that's a sign that they definitely feel like the regime is no longer viable.
Any sign of chaos in the streets, disagreements between people, arguments, fights over what will come next?
I haven't seen any disagreements over what will come next, and frankly, I haven't seen any signs of mass chaos. The only chaos that I've seen has been people trying to figure out how they're going to haul home things like refrigerators and forklifts. That's been really the only, people maybe have had disagreements over things that they're looting, but I haven't seen any sort of situations where people have been angry in the streets towards each other.
How are the people reacting to you, Andy? You're obviously an American and not an Iraqi. Are people coming up to you and shaking your hand or saying anything to you?
Yeah, I've had several people come up to me and greet me warmly and shake my hand. I've had people kiss me on the cheek. I've had people want to, as a photographer, I've had many people who have wanted to have their pictures taken. And also I've had people who have wanted to take my picture. So I've been, I haven't had any situations which I've have felt threatened. Actually, I've felt like the people have been quite warm.
And what happens next? Any idea?
Well, my plan for tomorrow is to push into the city center, and I assume that I shouldn't assume anything, but I'm thinking, and I think that the military planners are thinking that tomorrow will be, if not the final day of the war, nearly the final day of the war. So I'm excited about seeing what the situation is in the center of the city, and also continuing to document the reactions of the people, and then also how they're going to be carrying on with getting their lives back into some sort of a state of normalcy.
Andy, it's been really good of you to take the time to talk to us. Keep your head down, okay?
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That's Andy Nelson. He's a photographer with the Christian Science Monitor. Now, watching and listening to the day's events, along with us, is Basil Taki. He's an Iraqi businessman living in the United States. He's joining us now on the line from his office in Dearborn, Michigan. Basil, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Tell me what's in your mind today.
I don't know where to start, but it's that of jubilation, to say the least, and at the same time, a shock. I can't believe that Saddam has finally is in the history, is in the past tense. No more Saddam. That is a wonderful feeling after 35 years.
Now, you've been watching a little bit of this on television. Are you seeing places in Baghdad that are familiar to you? Are you seeing statues or images of Saddam Hussein being torn down that you remember from the time that you lived there back in the early 1980s?
Yes, I do recognize some of the areas, and I recognize some of the statues and pictures that are posted everywhere you turn in Baghdad and throughout Iraq, the places that I've been to. And it's a very wonderful feeling to see them finally coming down by different people that are expressing their happiness for the same thing that I'm happy about after all these years.
Now, Basil, more to the point, you have family in Baghdad as well. Have you been able to contact them to find out how they are?
Unfortunately, I haven't been able to. For the last 10, 11 days, I've tried, and as you know, all the communication centers throughout Baghdad and throughout Iraq have been hit, and therefore communication is very difficult, if not impossible. I have not been able to contact them at all.
You may have to wait for them to get to a phone to call you, I suppose. I gather that's what a lot of people are doing or are waiting for.
I am hoping that they are okay, and hopefully they will be able to contact me sometime soon. But I'm just keeping a positive attitude about the whole thing and looking forward to talking with them and perhaps even be with them sometime soon.
Now, Basil, you have been in this country for the last 20 years, or perhaps a little bit more than that, and so you know the way that that this war was put together and debated, and I'm interested in hearing your perspective about where we are now and what happens next, because, of course, there are as many unknowns as there are knowns. This is just still the very early stages.
That is absolutely correct. The beautiful thing about this country is the democracy and the way everybody is free to express their opinion. And there's always, in every issue, you're going to find people that are pro and people that are going to be against an issue. In this case, we saw a lot of people that were against the war. But the way we felt about it is that this war was the liberation of Iraq. The liberation of the people that have been in tyranny for so long. So if it wasn't for anything else, it was for the humanitarian reason for this to happen. As to what is going to happen in the future, I have nothing but positive thoughts because nothing is going to be as bad as Saddam. And from what I've been hearing from the American administration, from President Bush on down, they've all promised good things lie ahead. And I'm hoping that that will happen and take place. in the beginning of everything. I'm looking forward to the democracy and the freedom of the Iraqi people, because they surely do deserve it.
What you're saying is that really, no matter how difficult it's been for the people in Baghdad over the last 2 weeks, the what lies ahead for them, a life without Saddam Hussein, is going to be worth that.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. Obviously, one life is too many one life to lose is too many. That is what I believe in. But there is a price sometimes somebody has to pay in order to accomplish the purpose or the major or the bigger purpose in life. And I think for those people that have sacrificed their life, I think they have given a gift to the Iraqi people in general to look forward for the rest of their lives.
Basil, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us. I hope you get good news from your family and soon.
Looking forward to it. Thank you very much and have a nice day.
All right. Basil Taki is an Iraqi businessman joining us on the line from Dearborn, Michigan. Let's bring Dr. Thomas Barnett into the conversation. Thomas is a senior strategic researcher at the U.S. Naval War College. He's currently at work in the Office of the Secretary of Defense on the transformation of U.S. military capabilities to meet future threats, and lectures and speaks and writes frequently on how we're watching this world being changed by defense methods of years past and defense methods that we haven't even seen ahead of us. Mr. Barnett, tell me whether or not what you are hearing and seeing on radio and television today comes as a surprise to you, just the speed with which all this unfolded.
No, not really, in the sense that I know there was a lot of impatience expressed last week as we moved our forces progressively towards Baghdad. There was a lot of concern that we were stretching out our lines, that we were leaving ourselves open to all sorts of snags and difficulties from guerrilla warfare. But the way I tended to describe it to people was to say we shifted about 3 or 4 days ago from kind of the checkers part of the war to the chess part of the war. And the checkers part involved us moving space by space, fairly methodically, into the country, large numbers of troops, and getting them in a position around Baghdad where we could really wage the kind of war that we're capable of in terms of a very synergistic use of forces, very deep strikes, very rapid employment, very surgical strikes, and display an ability to really kind of pick the regime apart fairly quickly and to achieve a state where basically all his big pieces are gone now. And if Saddam lives, he's not surrounded by anything but pawns at this point. It's just a matter of tracking him down. So not surprised that things have gone well once we got to that point. A little concern that people aren't paying attention enough to all the bad things that haven't happened that were predicted. We're rushing right on to the next thing we're going to worry and fret about in terms of the humanitarian assistance that we have to shift to at this point. But a lot of good things have happened.
All right. We'll be back to talk with you, Thomas Barnett, and also with David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C., when we come back after the break. Connection listeners, is this the end of the war? What do the images that we're seeing and hearing about of Iraqis celebrating tell us about where we are and what happens next? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. And as Thomas Barnett so accurately pointed out just a couple of moments ago, the fighting in Iraq is not at an end. The hospitals in Baghdad have been overwhelmed with people shot, burned, and caught in the crossfire between soldiers. Even yesterday, supplies were running out. Today's story is even more worrisome. The number one agency for immediate wartime triage is the International Committee of the Red Cross. But according to Fuad Bawaba in Kuwait, their concern right now is for the safety of their own people.
The Ashrafi in Kuwait is now extremely concerned about the situation of the ICRC team in Baghdad.
Have you had any news about their safety or about their ability to even move around the city?
Yeah, actually, the ICRC team in Baghdad were unable to move in the city since this morning. And the situation is becoming chaotic there with incalculable risks, actually. And thus, the ICRC was unable to pursue its assistance for those in need. And thus, it is not in a position to carry out the humanitarian activities such as supporting hospitals or working on the water supply systems.
And what's the latest news that you're hearing from the hospitals in Baghdad, Fuad?
Since we are unable to move around, we were not able to visit the hospitals. But I can tell you that also the ICRC is extremely concerned about one of its staff members in Baghdad who has been unaccounted for since last Tuesday, that is yesterday in the afternoon. And he is feared to have been seriously injured when an ICRC vehicle which he was traveling in and another accompanying vehicle were hit by gunfire. Another two ICRC staff members managed to reach the ICRC offices who were also accompanying this staff member who has been unaccounted for since yesterday.
So, Fuad, what happens now if you have your own staff missing, people unable to move in the city, as you're describing? Does that mean that you appeal to the U.S. military for assistance? What do you do now?
We are just unable to pursue our humanitarian activities in Baghdad, but still the ICRC team will continue to assess the situation and will resume its activities if and when that is possible.
But you don't do that with the help or the assistance of one side or the other. It's important to be impartial?
Yeah, you know, as a humanitarian organization which is neutral and impartial, we try to be on the same level with the conflicting parties. So we do not, in this regard, we do not accept any escorts for our vehicles, for example, or something like that, because we are keen to keep on our neutrality.
Fuad, thank you for the time and good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
That's Fuad Bouaba. He's with the ICRC. He's head of the Red Cross office in Kuwait, and I guess pretty difficult to provide the sort of help that you need for people who need it when you can't even keep track of your own team. Let's go back to the two people who've graciously agreed to be with us on this day. Thomas Barnett is a senior strategic researcher at the U.S. Naval War College, currently working at the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And with him in a studio in Washington, David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C. David is a former weapons inspector of the Iraqi nuclear program. He's also worked as a senior staff scientist at the Federation of American Scientists, member of the research staff at Princeton University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. David, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Your thoughts on the story that's not being told today when the television cameras want to focus on the statues of Saddam Hussein and the cheering and the looting and the burning. How much aren't we focusing on in terms of where we are right now in Baghdad, in Iraq?
Well, there's another very important story is what's happened to the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction capabilities or actual chemical or biological weapons. Mm-hmm. And I think in the chaos of war, we do know that Iraq has lost control over these kinds of assets. And so what's happening to them? And so when I watch government buildings being looted, I worry that there may be facilities with very sensitive information, sensitive evidence in future investigations, perhaps even chemical or biological weapons or radioactive material that it may be disappearing now. And I think the United States can't be faulted for not providing the necessary protection. I mean, that's just mm-hmm. a fact of war. But I think it's extremely important that the United States and Britain and other allies move as quickly as possible to establish control over all the WMD assets, ballistic missile assets, and particularly over the scientists who are part of these programs, and not only to be able to interview those scientists about what may or may not exist in Iraq, but also to make sure that they're not going other places where they could cause this damage.
Thomas Barnett, what can happen at this time when nobody's really watching, as David describes, who's going where and who's got what? Are we in a situation similar to what happened in the collapse of the Soviet Union, where for days, weeks on end, sensitive areas were without power, without guards, that sort of thing?
Well, I guess I wouldn't necessarily buy into the notion that because chaos is being expressed in Iraqi society right now, and because the mass media that's there and the world outside is having a hard time getting a fix on things going on in Iraq, that concept of chaos extends to the operations of the U.S. military forces and the coalition forces in Iraq. I would argue that there is a tremendous focus displayed from day one, and actually from before day one of this conflict, by U.S. forces in terms of locating and putting their hands on the people and the assets and the facilities connected with the weapons of mass destruction production and efforts under the Hussein regime. So because it looks scary and out of control in Baghdad, where we're looking at a society that's been kept in deep isolation in a very Stalinist, frightening form of government for several decades, that kind of explosion is completely natural. I don't think we should read too much into it that all sorts of security issues are being muddled or necessarily lost in the larger chaos of what's going on there. I think we should assume that these things are being pursued with great vigor, now even more so with the fighting ended between coalition forces and Iraqi forces.
David, you don't have that confidence?
No, because we've already seen it. I mean, if you take the Tuwaita Nuclear Research Center, that place was emptied out, or put it this way, the Iraqis left a couple days before the 101st arrived. Mm-hmm. And many of these sites are in areas where coalition forces are not located. And so I don't think it's a question of what we're seeing in the media. I think it's a real question that there just haven't been enough people deployed by the United States. For example, there were some high-priority sites that the Special Forces visited. They found nothing. And the concern is that even at the sites that are known about, in a sense, production sites, that there's been a vacuum between the time the Iraqis leave and the time the U.S. or British forces can arrive.
And what's the risk there, though, David?
It can be dismissed as a concern because we've seen it already in Iraq. And that.
But who gets control of it? That's what I'm not clear on. I mean, in that vacuum, who are you worried about getting their hands on material that could be dangerous?
Could be anybody. If it could just be the local population. It could be someone who has some more sinister motivations. Perhaps someone wants to make some money and sees some assets as worth grabbing and leaving with. And so I think that it's just a fact of life, and we can't dismiss it and act like that everything's going according to plan, because we're seeing it in front of us right now, that these assets are not being protected, and that it's important that the United States and Britain move very quickly to try to gain control. And in that, I would say it's important to start to draw in the international community. For example, the United States does not have the resources, despite what they say. And in fact, I'm not even sure they would say that privately. They haven't said it to me privately, to actually get control over this system. There are thousands of Iraqis who are involved in their weapons of mass destruction programs. There's many sites, and that it's the people who have the knowledge about those sites typically were involved in the inspection process. And I think that it's very important that those kinds of people be brought back in and ultimately bring back the inspection agencies like UNMOVIC, mm-hmm, and the action team to try to better help us understand what's there and to reassert control over these things.
What do you think, Thomas Barnett? Does the U.S. have the wherewithal to do this?
Well, again, I would emphasize what's gone right so far and how the predictions of everything kind of going against us have not proven true. When we went into this conflict, we were warned about all sorts of horrible scenarios and outcomes. We were going to have terrorist strikes in the United States. This was going to be a long war. There was going to be a huge nationalistic response, a fight to the death across this country. Muslims were going to rise up throughout the region. You were going to see an intifada develop on site very rapidly. There was going to be huge urban warfare, huge loss of life on both sides. There was probably going to be the use of weapons of mass destruction in some sort of Gad or Damerung scenario, Saddam in the bunker kind of situation. There would be a huge humanitarian disaster that we could not access because we wouldn't be able to establish control. None of those things have really happened. And now we've moved on to a whole new series of things.
I don't want to be the voice of NPR Quagmire, but we don't really know that those things aren't going to happen, do we?
Well, I'd have to see the arguments that these things have happened.
Yeah.
There is going to be a humanitarian crisis. There was one before we got there. There's definitely one now with the additional destruction and the collapse of the regime, but we can access it. I mean, it's not a situation where people are suffering behind lines that we can't get to. We've already moved on to a whole new series of issues in such rapid time that what I like to just say is I like to caution and remind people of all the things we worried about that were supposedly going to drag on for weeks or months that have gone away, and now we're moving on to a whole new series of issues and concerns, and people are making the same predictions that these are going to be out of control and these are going to drag on for months and years and all sorts of opportunities are going to be lost. And I think those kinds of judgments come off as a little premature. We've got a new series of issues. We're rapidly shifting from one sort of situation to another, but a lot of good things have happened. A lot of issues that we worried about have gone by the wayside. It's good that we're already worrying about, in effect, loose nukes and loose WMDs escaping from the country and the safety and the effectiveness of non-governmental organizations and humanitarian relief organizations. I mean, it's an amazing achievement to get to this point and have these sorts of worries 15-20 days into a conflict.
Let me just stop you there if I can, Thomas, because
sure.
we want to just go briefly to a comment from U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney. He was scheduled to speak earlier today to the American Society of Newspaper Editors in New Orleans, and I suspect he probably had to change his script a little bit. Let's just listen to a little bit of what the Vice President had to say.
Operations continue all across Iraq, securing cities, protecting supply lines, delivering tons of humanitarian aid. In downtown Baghdad this morning, we're seeing evidence of the collapse of any central regime authority.
That's Vice President Dick Cheney speaking earlier today to the American Society of Newspaper Editors in, I believe, in New Orleans, Louisiana. And you're listening to The Connection from NPR. One note just from the images that we're getting, and there are many of them coming out of Baghdad at this hour. I mentioned earlier in the program this 20-foot-high dark statue of Saddam Hussein with one arm raised that's in the middle of one of the principal squares in Baghdad, in Firdaus Square. And some of the residents had looped a rope around the neck and tried to get the statue down. I can tell you now that American soldiers using some equipment have now draped an American flag over the face of that particular statue, and they're working with some equipment now to help tear it down. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Frank, who's called in from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Frank.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Taking my call. Yes, I was just watching on TV the statue you just mentioned, the 20-foot-tall statue, and what I say, it's a small crowd hanging around it. If that's the perspective we're going to get from the people of Baghdad, I think that's bad news. Because
why do you say that, Frank?
Okay, for once, I once lived under the dictatorship in Portugal that fell in 1974, and people came out on the streets by the hundreds of thousands, I mean actually millions all over the country.
Right.
You could even find space to walk. So I don't see this happening in Baghdad. I see a small crowd of 100 or 200 people at most. I saw other people with their hands on their hips sitting on by the sidewalks, I mean, just looking neutral or disgusted. So I don't really see jubilation there. And I'm pretty sure I'm an average citizen, so I'm a human being. So those people, that's the way they're reacting. It's bad news for us. I mean, we're not going to get what we expected, to have these crowds come up and be all crazy.
David Albright, you've been a weapons inspector in Iraq, and the description that Frank's giving us of his comparison of you know, the few hundreds that we've seen on our television screens and heard about on the radio compared to the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands in various Eastern European squares. Is that an apt comparison at this point? What do you think?
Well, I think it's not apt right now, because although there's a point there, it's not apt because people are still worried about getting shot, and they want to remain at home. Where it is apt is, I think, the sort of, let me just call it the neocons, and some of the people who tried to always put a positive spin on a war in Iraq predicted that the people of Iraq would be out in the streets cheering, and that hasn't been the case.
Well, somewhere
and I think
today.
That it's I think we're going to have to work this problem very hard to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqis and try to get smiles on their faces. And I think it's not going to help us if the United States and Britain do this alone. I mean, maybe it'll work out. I mean, sometimes things work out, but that's not a strategy for success. You can't just say, oh, everything's positive, and we can just count on it remaining positive. It hasn't been positive all the way so far, and I think that it's misleading to say that everything's gone according to plan and it's all been good news. It hasn't all been good news, and I think this caller's pointed out one of the aspects of that is that the Iraqi people are waiting to see what's going to happen. They may not like the next authority that rules their lives, and there's a lot of issues that we're going to have to wrestle with, and I think we should be searching for help in this problem, and help not only to legitimize the authority, the military authority that's going to inevitably take over Iraq for many months, and also looking for help financially. I mean, Iraq is not going to be an economic miracle anytime soon, and there's going to be a need for a tremendous amount of money to flow into Iraq. And I think I would be more comfortable if it wasn't just U.S. money.
All right, David, let me just stop you there. We'll hear more on that from you and from Thomas Barnett when we come back after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Frank, thank you for that call. And more calls and comments, connection listeners, from you when we come back after the break. Your thoughts, your reactions to what we're hearing today from Baghdad. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Well, on this morning, Connection listeners, reporters with National Public Radio are allowed to tell us what's going on in Baghdad without the accompaniment of government minders, without the assistance and the direction of people telling them what it is they're supposed to talk about and what it is they're supposed to report on. Let's just listen into a couple of snippets from earlier today. John Burnett and Anne Garrels, NPR, reporting from Baghdad.
Yes, and that really was kind of the feature of what I've seen so far. It seems like Baghdad has been turned into one giant Sam's Wholesale.
Cars, whatever they can get their hands on. There are cars all over the city at this point that are either being pushed or pulled. A lot of Toyota Land Cruisers, Toyota Avalons, favored cars of higher level officials. And the thieves couldn't find the keys, so they're making off with them whatever way they can.
And then this remarkable scene happened when I went to the Republican Guard has its own stables where they keep their cavalry horses. Mm-hmm. And so, but they're gone now. The Republican Guard has fled. And so I walked over there with some Marines, and there were all these young men coming out of the apartment buildings trying to catch these horses, these beautiful chestnut horses. And they had halters and they were running around. It reminded me of a Texas rodeo calf scramble, you know, being dragged by the horses, some of them successfully riding them bareback, others just kind of running in circles, shouting at them.
That was John Burnett and a little bit of Ann Garrels reporting earlier today from Baghdad. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We have Judith Yaffe on the line. She's Middle East Project Director of the Institute of National Strategic Studies, worked for some 20 years as a senior analyst on Middle Eastern and Persian Gulf issues. Judith, welcome to The Connection.
Thanks for inviting me.
You were here last week talking about the historical relationship between the United States and Iraq, and I guess we are in the process of turning another page in that relationship today. Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I'm thinking that we're turning another page in that history, as you said. It's a work in progress. It's very interesting to watch what's going on. And almost a contrast what happens in Iraq with the way it's perceived outside. But clearly, it's not over yet.
What's the part of the story that you think is important to focus on now that's not necessarily on a television screen?
Well, I guess the story for me is personally is where have they all gone? Where is Saddam? Where's Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, who was his so eloquent a spokesman and on all the time? Where are these other people? Have they just vanished into thin air? Have they died in the bombardment? What's happened? I think the story, though, the greater public story has to be our efforts to establish some kind of order out of chaos. We need to get law and order back on the streets and in the towns and cities as soon as possible and make sure that food, water, medicine, aid flow in as quickly as possible.
Judith, we have Thomas Barnett on the line as well with us. And Thomas, this is your area of expertise, defense planning. I'm wondering if in your view or in your knowledge, the strategy of moving from, you know, reducing the threat to a type of occupation that also stops the looting and begins the process of reintroducing some sort of civil administration in Baghdad. Is there somebody in that city now who's got a file folder who's turning to page 2 or 3?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
I mean, from the start of this whole thing, there were indications from the Bush administration that they were going to take serious responsibility for the aftermath. So that was part of military planning from the start. In many ways, what we're dealing with here are problems of success, which has been the problem we've had all along. Things have gone a little too well, a little too fast, and what may have been assumptions about this kind of state being reached in weeks, now it comes in days. So what you're going to see, I think, is a natural scramble on our part to deal with the fact that it's gone even faster than a lot of people have assumed.
Judith Yaffe, what are you going to be watching for in the week ahead?
I'd like to add to what he said. There has been planning for some time as to what would be needed, how do we go about it, who's going to provide what. But I would say in part, we may have started too late, but you never have enough time to prepare for the needs in a crisis like this. It's going to end too soon. You're not going to be ready. You're not going to have enough there. And I think we'll have underestimated the amount of support that will be needed. And I'm just thinking in terms of immediately food, water, medicine. There was an assumption, I think, apart, you know, people may have believed that Saddam really did give every Iraqi 6 months of supplies. That, first of all, that was at least 2 months ago, but every Iraqi didn't get it. Many Iraqis who might have received additional supplies would have sold them in order to buy medicine or other things that were highly needed. In other words, we're walking into an unsure environment. We'll have some things available, but I just question whether it'll be enough. And I'm not faulting the planning in that sense because I don't think you're ever really prepared for it.
All right, Judith, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Sure.
Judith Yaffe is Middle East Project Director at the Institute for National Strategic Studies. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin now. Saud's on the line. Hi, Saud.
Hello.
Thanks
How
for
are you
calling.
Doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
What are you thinking?
I'm calling, first of all, to thank what the military and the American people have done, the sacrifices that have occurred to free the Iraqi people. I'm also calling in regards to a comment about another caller who was saying that he doesn't think there is jubilation downtown Baghdad. And I'm calling in regards to the fact that if you've lived in Baghdad, and if you understand the people of Baghdad.
Have you lived there, Saud?
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
I have lived there. I am an Iraqi-American right now. I understand what goes on, the mentality of the 24 years of this occupation, of this torture, and the fear that it has instilled into people. And a lot of the people in Baghdad, unlike Basra and Nasriya and all those people, the people in Baghdad, there's a huge amount of them that are highly intellectual and educated. and they know better not to walk around the streets, even at this time, you know, throwing their slippers and rocks at the statue. The people, the few hundreds that you do see.
You don't happen to have a television on it where you are now, do you, Saud?
No, unfortunately not. I'm actually late to work because I try to see as much of it as I can. But
I can tell you the image that all the networks are zeroing in on is that statue in Firdaus Square, which was slowly pulled to what is now a horizontal position. It did not come off its pedestal in the dramatic fashion that Vladimir Lenin fell across the Soviet Union. But
yes,
this is the sort of scene that you're saying the ordinary people are out in the street to see. What is it that's keeping the intellectual class inside? What is it that they're waiting for?
They know better not to do that, because not until there is, as you would say, as a scientist would get 100% confirmation on a theory, that they would, the fact that they have to know 100% that this Baath party and this president is actually out, that they will voice their concerns, or not concerns, they will voice their happiness.
Right.
And the way they will voice it is not by going out on the street and throwing out white flags and stuff. No, they're not that sort of people. They are very, how would I say, they're much more higher educated to do something like that. They would perhaps throw a party, or they would actually speak in a very professional manner to a reporter on the road. But the higher class Iraqi families would keep to themselves, and they would actually stay in their houses.
Okay, Saud, I'm going to interrupt you because I don't want you to be any more late for work on behalf of The Connection. Thank you for calling in. David Albright, you're listening to what Saud's saying about the difference in the who we're seeing in the street. You're a scientist. You've been there working with that educated class. Has he got it right?
It's not that large of a class. I mean, Iraqis are pretty well educated. I mean, I think more people will celebrate Saddam's downfall as time goes on and the streets of Baghdad become safer. And I am glad for that, and that they should rejoice at the downfall of Saddam Hussein and his horrible regime. In terms of what I know of the educated class that I've met as an inspector or just people on the street, I mean, there's a lot of anti-American feeling there. I mean, they often thought I was a German because, I don't know, this is the way I dressed and I speak German. If I'd answer in English or identify myself as an American, the reaction was hostile. So I think and part of that has to do with the simple fact that the country was conditioned to really be anti-American. So I think we're going to have to prove ourselves to the Iraqi educated class and the broader Iraqi society that we aren't just the people who brought them 10 years of horrific sanctions, and that we actually are going to improve their lives. And I think we're going to have to work at it. And I don't think we should take it for granted that we will be welcomed as liberators. And there may be rejoicing now, but there's going to be some hard fights. I can remember discussions in the mid-90s with Israelis, colleagues in Europe here, partly why people didn't count on regime change as the solution to the, in a sense, the weapons of mass destruction program, was that it's a very tough neighborhood and there's a lot of contentiousness within Iraqi society. And so there was a sense that 5 years from now, or 5 years after Saddam goes, we could be wrestling with these weapons of mass destruction questions again, just because of the nature of the neighborhood and Iraqi society.
All right. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Thomas Barnett, just a thought from you about the way that the U.S. needs to rehabilitate its image in Iraq. And I say that in part to based on my own experience there as a reporter. And I can't actually say whether or not the message from ordinary Iraqis is one that they told me because they thought this is what the regime wanted me to hear. But there was a tremendous amount of criticism against Western countries, that was the countries that were enforcing the sanctions and the no-fly zones, because that's what they had been told by Saddam Hussein was making their life so miserable. Is that a big climb back to reestablish the sort of confidence that David's describing is required?
Well, I think there's a lot of discussion about the goals that we have for an Iraq and how rapidly they can be achieved. And a lot of people are putting this in terms of democracy and how quickly democracy can flourish in Iraq. I think that's the wrong way to focus on it. I think the way we get their confidence back or we improve our image in the region is we show that taking down Saddam's regime leads to Iraq becoming so much more connected with the global community. This is a country that's been deeply isolated, kept offline, and treated very abusively for decades. If what they see coming out of this is lots of connectivity with the outside world, lots of choice in terms of the ideas that they're exposed to, the economic opportunities they can pursue, then I think we get a better future for that part of the world. And I think you're going to see democracy come about more naturally over the longer term. To me, it's about connectivity in the short term and encouraging them to really open up and find their own way and make their own choices.
We're near the end of the program, and I'd like to hear both of you on one final point, and that is that we're making judgments and decisions and forming ideas based on what we're hearing from American reporters and watching American television pictures out of Baghdad. You will both know that the images out of Baghdad on Al Jazeera and some of the Middle Eastern networks will carry more shots of the people who are injured in the hospitals and people who are complaining about the trials that they've been put through by the American attack. Are you in any way concerned that that there's a tipping point when the Americans need to persuade the rest of the world that what's happening in Iraq is good? Perhaps, David, you briefly, and then to Thomas.
Well, this isn't quite the answer perhaps you were asking or looking for, but if I could just go back to the weapons of mass destruction, we... In a sense, as an analyst, you hope they're not there, because if they're there in large number, they're easier to use. But the world's going to be looking now after the war's end.
Right.
Did Iraq have weapons of mass destruction? And particularly at the levels the U.S. administration was asserting, large stocks, deployed, ready to use. And
right.
I think...
David, I take your point. We are so short with time. Thomas, would like to hear you very briefly on the way that this is being seen through other eyes.
Well, I think there's a lot of fear and trepidation in a lot of traditional cultures in that part of the world as to whether this will represent a sort of big bang. If Iraq can show that it can come out of this deep isolation and pursue a better pathway where people are allowed to experience much more freedom and economic choice and opportunity, that's going to be a very compelling precedent that's going to challenge an Iran and a Syria and other countries, a Saudi Arabia in the region, and possibly push their people to ask similar questions. All right. Why can't we have that?
Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be with us in such a changing program. Your insights were very helpful to us. Thomas Barnett, Senior Strategic Researcher at the U.S. Naval War College. David Albright, President of the Institute of Science and International Security. Earlier in the program, Basil Taki, an Iraqi-American living in Dearborn. Fuad Bawaba with the ICRC in Kuwait. Judith Yaffe from the Institute for National Strategic Studies. And, of course, Andrew Nelson, photographer of the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Baghdad. You can see his images on our website. I'm Dick Gordon.